Hello and welcome to Background Briefing. I'm Ian Masters and today we'll examine a number of stories and issues in the news. We'll begin with the fallout from the resignation letter by a Goldman Sachs executive and explore the broader issue of public morality at a time when Republican presidential candidates are campaigning on enforcing a holier-than-thou private morality, mostly about sex. Mike Lux, the CEO of Progressive Strategies, joins us to discuss how the focus in this election can be turned to address the morally bankrupt behavior and toxic and destructive environment of Wall Street. Then, as the screws turn on Iran with today's closure of its access to international bank transfers, we will look into Iran's aggressive and defensive foreign policy and the extent to which sanctions are hurting the Iranian people, but not the regime. Nada Hashimi, a professor of Middle East and Islamic politics at the Joseph Corbell School of International Studies at the University of Denver, joins us. Then finally, as the rising price of gas becomes a central issue in this year's election campaigns, we will talk with Michael Clare about his new book, The Race for What's Left, The Global Scramble for the World's Last Resources, and discuss how costly and increasing risks will be taken to extract the last drops of oil, exposing the environment to greater danger. Joining us now is Mike Lux, a partner at Democracy Partners and co-founder and CEO of Progressive Strategies. He served as a special assistant to the president for public liaison in the White House from 1993 to 1995. He's the author of the widely praised book, The Progressive Revolution, How the Best in America Came to Be. Welcome to Background Briefing, Mike Lux.
Thank you for having me. It's great to be here.
And you've written about the Goldman Sachs executive, his mea culpa, in the New York Times yesterday, Greg Smith, talking about the toxic and destructive environment at Goldman Sachs. And you've written about that in the Huffington Post, Mike. And the New York Times today carried a front page story, continuing that conversation, if you will. I spoke with a Wall Street insider yesterday. He wrote an expose on Goldman Sachs, and he more or less said, you know, well, there's nothing new about it. This has been going on forever. And after all, Senator Levin had that hearing where he kept repeating the word that I can't repeat 11 times about the kind of deals that Goldman Sachs were foisting on their unfortunate yeah. clients. But it clearly got to you. So give me your reaction to it and why you think it has resonance in this current political race.
Well, look, I think that that voters tend to look at least as much, if not more, frankly, at their perceptions about morals and who shares their values than about specific policy issues. Most voters don't follow the details of policies all that much. There are exceptions to that. I think, for example, on health care, people are more policy-oriented because they know so much about their own health care coverage and how it affects their life. But I think for the most part, voters don't tend to follow the ins and outs of the budget politics or specific policy debates, but they do get a sense of who shares their values, who believes what they do, who has their same sort of sense of morality. And Republicans spend a lot of time talking about morality because they are aware that appeals to voters. But when you've got somebody like Mitt Romney, who is so close to Goldman Sachs, I mean, he operated his company the way Goldman Sachs has operated their company for the last few years, and the way Smith described in this piece that everybody's talking about yesterday in the New York Times. So you've got a guy. I mean, Romney is the biggest single source of his contributions come from Goldman Sachs executives. He's done all kinds of business deals with them over the years. He's got all kinds of investments with them, even today. So you've got a guy who's like completely linked to this company. And this company, I mean, what Smith said, the only thing surprising about it was that he was a Goldman insider. You know, the kinds of things that he was talking about were not surprises to anybody who's followed the company. They do have a toxic culture. They are corrupt as hell. So, for them and for people like Romney to be so linked, I think it's important for us to make that point.
So, Mike Lux, how do you then turn this debate about religious morality and an almost, going back to the kind of pilgrim days of the Scarlet Letter and witch burning in terms of its sort of the intensity of Santorum's reactionary religion and the notion that we're talking about women's, not just women's reproductive rights, but their access to contraception now. The conservatives are very effectively moving the clock back. And if you're saying it's ultimately distracting us from the real discussion about public morality, who's going to turn this around and focus on the real discussion?
Well, I think it's the job of progressives everywhere to do that. You know, the point that one of the points that I made in my piece in HuffPo that you referenced was the morality debate to me is fascinating because you've got a bunch of people like Romney and Santorum who proclaim at every juncture their deep faith in Jesus as their savior. And yet, if you actually read the Bible, Jesus was far more concerned with how the poor were treated. He was far more concerned with social reform to give poor people more and to he told wealthy people of his time that they had no chance of going to heaven unless they gave all their money to the poor. He challenged the authorities at every point on matters of social justice. He started his whole ministry with a sermon where he said that he wanted the rich to forgive the debts of the poor, right? So and he was a guy who Jesus was a person who almost never talked about sexual sins. I mean he never mentioned abortion, even though it was common in those times. He never mentioned gay people, even though homosexuality was very common in that era of history. He didn't talk about that stuff. He barely touched on adultery. He would sometimes list adultery in a long list of sins of things to avoid, but he almost never talked about that stuff. What he talked about was helping the poor, and that the wealthy should be helping the poor, and that society should be helping the poor. That's the irony of someone like Santorum, who is so obsessed with sex. You know, he doesn't want people to have sex. He doesn't want he doesn't want people to use birth control. He's crazed about it. And the guy that he says he's following wasn't crazed about it. The guy who he says he's following didn't ever mention it in his entire 3-year ministry. So there's some funny business going on among conservatives on this whole morality debate.
Yeah, well, it's I recall in the Bible it's easy for a camel to go through the eye of a needle than for a rich man to enter the kingdom of heaven.
Exactly.
Are you talking about then that the Democrats should revive the religious left?
Well, I absolutely think they should. You know, if you look at the history of this country, the religious left was the core of many of the progressive movements in the history of this country. They were at the core of the abolitionist movement. They were at the core of the movement for women's rights and women's suffrage. They were at the core of the populist movement. I mean, a great example, William Jennings Bryan, who gave that amazing Cross of Gold speech and spent his entire career going after big corporations and the bankers in the East, but obviously ended his career on this note of being a fundamentalist Christian. But to people like Brian, it was never a contradiction. And then you've got in the modern era, you've got people like Martin Luther King modern day reformers, environmentalists who talk about being stewards of the land. I mean, throughout American history, the religious left has played a huge role in social change. And so whatever your own views on religion, I think that progressives should be aware of that history and should embrace the moral teachings of Jewish and Christian and other religions, and not ignore them.
So you mentioned William Jennings Bryan, and of course at the end of the 19th century, in the late 1800s, when he ran against McKinley, outspent, I believe, something like 200-1 in the earlier Gilded Age from the one that we're in now, he made the very prophetic remark that the great challenge for what was to be the 20th century, the great challenge for the next century, is to protect the God-made man from the man-made God, the corporation. And here you have, which is actually one of the reasons I'd called you, Mark, was I want to talk about what can Obama and the Democrats do about Citizens United. It's just so obvious that that was a partisan vote, just like Bush v. Gore, and it's having a very, very dire partisan consequence. Yeah. Obama is simply not raising the kind of money that these super PACs are raising, and you've got the Koch brothers saying they'll spend $100-200 million, whatever it takes, to defeat Obama, and they're off to the races.
Yeah, it is it's a massive problem in a democracy to have this kind of unlimited, unregulated, unreported in many cases spending by these major corporations, and it's a huge challenge. I think that there's a couple of things that can be done. One is what I call the inoculation strategy. I think the Democrats have to be very focused on letting people know well in advance that these corporations are coming into these races with all this crap. I think they should remind them that, you know, whenever you see, you know, ads from these sleazeball groups, that they're paid for. We know that they're paid for because we've had insiders report it by the bankers, by the oil companies, by all these big business interests. Some of the groups that are running the ads have undeniably taken foreign money, but they won't admit who they're taking it from. The Chamber of Commerce was documented in 2010 taking money from foreign corporations and funneling the money into these ads. So this is a major threat to American democracy, and I think we need to be very out front in pushing back on it and in letting people know. You're going to see a whole bunch of crap. Whenever you see it, think about who's paying for it. And I think that needs to be a very, very overt message. I think that Obama and progressive Democrats can win races if they go on the attack against these big businesses who are dumping all this money in the race, and if they take them on. I think if we talk about Romney and Bain Capital and what he did there, and the fact that he's a tool of Goldman Sachs. I think that can make a huge difference. And then when you are getting outspent, people will remember that the reason you're getting outspent is because of these corporations. The other thing I think that needs to happen, and we've seen good signs of it already, but more and more organizations are coming together. There was a big press conference here in the last few days in D.C. of big national organizations saying, "Look, if we find out these corporations are dumping money into these ads, we're going to boycott them. We're going to take them on with shareholder resolutions. We're going to try to destroy their brand." The way groups did with Target in the last election cycle, when they gave a bunch of money to a far right wing group, and they were badly hurt by that. So I think progressive groups and bloggers and other individuals need to be very aggressive in going after these corporations when we find out they give this kind of money.
Well, just in closing, Mike Lux, what is the president going to do about the issue where he's most vulnerable? Boehner said some time ago that the price of gas is going to be the best issue that the Republicans can run on, and boy, is that proving to be the case.
Yep.
And the recent New York Times CBS poll indicated that the president had dropped precipitously on the issue of his apparent inability to do anything about it. My understanding is that one-third of the price of gasoline at the pump comes from speculation on Wall Street.
Yep.
Is the president going to take on Wall Street?
Well, he absolutely has to. I think there's two answers on the gas prices thing. Number one is to go after those speculators. I think that is a great message in large part because it's true. I mean, the speculators have driven up the price of oil at several different times in the last few years. They're doing it again. And we need to go straight at that. We need to make sure that people understand that. I think the second thing is to say, look, if oil prices and oil company profits are on the rise, who do you trust more to take on the oil industry? Who do you trust more to go after these guys and to hold them accountable and to force them to the table when it comes to the abuses that they're doing? Is it the Republicans you trust more who get all this money from oil companies, or is it the Democrats? And I think you need to make that very clear distinction, very clear populist case as to who are you going to trust more to take on the oil companies.
Well, thank you so much for joining us here today, Mike Lux.
Thank you so much for having me. It's been fun.
Again, I've been speaking with Mike Lux, a partner at Democracy Partners and the co-founder and CEO of Progressive Strategies. He served as a special assistant to the president for public liaison in the White House from 1993 to 1995, and he's the author of the widely praised book, The Progressive Revolution, How the Best in America Came to Be. We're going to take a brief station break, and we'll be back talking about pressure on Iran.
What's in your head is really started showing. Your conversation's getting kind of boring. Don't believe nothing you say, 'cause I'm around and I see what you do. You know you're yeah, then a mosquito's leader. You got a mouth like a herd of boll weavers. Same old game, same old game. Always rapping about the same old thing.
Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters. This is Background Briefing. And joining us now is Adnana Hashimi, who is a professor of Middle East and Islamic politics at the Joseph Corbell School of International Studies at the University of Denver. He's the author of Islam, Secularism, and Liberal Democracy, Towards a Democratic Theory for Muslim Societies. And his latest book is The People Reloaded, The Green Movement, and the Struggle for Iran's Future. Welcome to Background Briefing, Adnana Hashimi.
Happy to be with you.
And clearly there are indications of both aggressiveness on the part of the Iranian regime and also a sense that they're under siege and that things aren't going well for them. Let's start with the news today that the SWIFT system, the Society of Worldwide Interbank Financial Telecommunications, which is the means by which all banks around the world operate through the system of being able to make wire transfers, Iran's been cut off from this. This is going to have a very severe consequences, not just for Iran's ability to trade oil on the global market, but it's also going to have an impact on the Iranian diaspora sending money back home, isn't it?
Well, it absolutely is. I'm getting reports from a lot of Iranian citizens, ordinary folk, students studying abroad. Now they can't, make their financial payments on their rents, on money transfers. I mean, this is affecting actually hundreds of thousands, if not millions, of Iranians who have relatives abroad and need to send money to their loved ones. And so this speaks to the larger, I think, point here with respect to American and Western sanctions against Iran. The reason why they are opposed by the Green Movement, by most democratic activists, is because they don't distinguish between the regime and the average citizen. There's a lot of innocent people who have no say, no input, no ability to shape the foreign policy of the Islamic Republic of Iran. They're being victimized and they're being affected by these broad-based economic sanctions. And so that's why I, for one, you know, oppose them, because the average citizen, the average, you know, member of the middle class, precisely those people who would we want to support and strengthen if we want to support a democratic transition in Iran, are being affected by these sanctions.
So on the other side, you get, there's a front page story in the New York Times today about Iran arming the rebels in Yemen. We know that Iran's been active in supporting the al-Assads and their recent assault on Homs and the rest of the cities in the north of Syria. And Ahmadinejad's deputy just visited the Israeli border with Hezbollah and shouted at the Israelis across the wire, pretty much, we're coming to get you. So this is a disconnect. You've got people suffering, the Iranian people suffering at home, and yet you've got this very aggressive foreign policy where they're supporting, arming rebels, supporting an outlaw regime, and picking a fight with the Israelis.
Yeah, it depends on what perspective you take. I mean, you described it as a very sort of aggressive foreign policy. That policy and behavior that we're seeing from Iran right now can be described as defensive in the context of the possibility, very real possibility, that we could be at war with Iran within the next few months. And I think the events that you pointed to are an attempt by the Iranian regime to sort of send a message to the West that, look, if there is going to be a war, it's going to be a war that's not only going to affect Iran, it's going to affect Western interests in the Middle East as well. And so the Israel-Lebanon border is one place where Iran can flex some muscle. Yemen, more importantly, I think, Afghanistan, where there are about 90,000 American troops there, a very long border. Iran can, make life very difficult for an American military presence there that is already on very thin ice. And so, I mean, this speaks to a larger point. One of the shocking things I sort of have noticed in the debate here in the West with respect to Iran's nuclear program and the sort of attempt to sort of the discussion about a military strike is that there seems to be this misreading of the fact that a military strike on Iran is somehow similar to going to Walmart and buying a pair of socks. In other words, there's no consequences for the world were that to happen. And I think Iran is sending a message that if it were to be attacked over its nuclear program by the United States or Israel, that it has a lot of cards that it can play that can make life very difficult for the West, particularly with respect to the question of oil.
Again, I'm speaking with Nat Hashemi, who is Professor of Middle East and Islamic Politics at the Joseph Corbell School of International Studies at the University of Denver. He's the author of The People Reloaded, The Green Movement and the Struggle for Iran's Future. Now, when you mentioned a minute ago U.S.'s vulnerability in Afghanistan, I just spoke with a U.S. captain who served with the 10th Mountain Division, and his platoon took the highest casualties of any American unit since Gettysburg, 80% casualties. And he said after every battle, when they go and pick up all the weapons that the enemy has dropped on the battlefield, they were all brand new Iranian rifles, assault rifles, and RPGs, etc., all with the, you know, made in Iran stamped on them. And this American captain was saying to me, you know, I don't understand why this doesn't get more publicity. So what explains that?
I think the explanation is the one that I sort of hinted at a moment ago, that Iran has a lot of cards that it can play politically and militarily if it is attacked by the United States. Iran is not simply going to sit there and watch its economy collapse and watch its nuclear program be degraded by the United States and or Israel. And so it will start to hit back in those areas where I think the West is very vulnerable. And as we've seen over the last couple of weeks, the United States in particular is very vulnerable in Afghanistan. And I'm not speaking just about the recent set of events that have made life very difficult for the Karzai government, which we in the West are supporting. But, you know, it's generally known that the United States is having a very difficult time winning the war in Afghanistan. Just imagine what would happen if Iran decides to invest a lot of money and time and energy in supporting the Taliban much more with much greater vigor than they're doing right now. I mean, that's one of the consequences, one among many of the consequences that we are likely to see should there be a military strike on Iran. So I think that's really the context that explains the events that you were just describing.
Well, it certainly explains the Iranian side of it, but I imagine what's going on the American side is that our government and our military don't want to tell the American people that Iran is doing terrible things, because they'll only rile up the American people, and the American people will expect the United States to do something about it. And here we have a situation where the U.S. is actually trying to restrain Israel from attacking Iran. And I take it the reality here is there's not a lot that the U.S. can do.
There's not a lot that U.S. can do. I mean, but the worst thing they can do would be to start a war, because once you start a war, as we know from history, it's very easy to start a war. It's very difficult to end one. And that's why I think, you know, the argument that has been advanced recently by Paul Pillar in the Washington Monthly, that given a choice between attacking Iran and unleashing a war versus living and accepting the fact that Iran one day will get a nuclear program and possibly a nuclear weapon, if you have to make those two choices, the latter one is the less dangerous one for our world. Now, that's something that you don't often hear in the public debate. There is this apocalyptic scenario that were Iran to obtain a nuclear program, that would be, you know, the end of Western civilization. I'm exaggerating, of course, but only slightly. But I think, you know, the policies, at least the rhetoric that we're hearing, is very disconcerting. And, you know, if God forbid there is actually a war, you know, all bets are off in terms of what the consequences will be, both in human terms and in material terms, for not only the Middle East, but for the entire planet.
Well, I think it's reasonable to assume, isn't it, Nader Hashemi, that after the election, that perhaps the agreement that Obama got with Netanyahu on his recent visit was, look, you know, just don't do anything before the election because it's going to raise the price of gas, and I'm history, and I imagine, you know, it's difficult for the president to get an agreement out of Netanyahu. And apparently, just very recently, in the last day, Netanyahu addressed the Israeli parliament and suggested that there was no deal, that they may go ahead and attack Iran. So it's difficult to know what kind of deal was made. And we know that Netanyahu's much, much more comfortable with Republicans. So either way, it looks pretty bleak in terms of a non-war scenario, because if the deal that Obama was able to restrain Netanyahu with is, look, we'll take care of this after the elections, that's one possibility. The other possibility is that if a Republican gets in, based upon what they're saying, particularly Romney, who's supposed to be the reasonable one, you know, the minute he gets into the Oval Office, he's going to start bombing Iran.
Yeah, no, you're right. It doesn't look very positive in either direction, either the Republican or the Democratic direction. I think one of the big concerns here is a misunderstanding that could possibly trigger a war. And, you know, I think we've begun to travel down this path where some sort of confrontation is inevitable, because Iran is not going to give up its right to enrich uranium and to develop the capacity, or the know-how at least, to produce a nuclear weapon. And the West is not going to sort of relinquish its determination and its stance to prevent that from happening. So I can't really see a way out, because neither side is willing to blink. And so the question is, as we move forward every month, there are going to be important and very influential political voices, both in the United States and in Israel, that are going to be basically pressing the United States and the Obama administration to, quote, do something about Iran. And and so it remains to be seen exactly how the Obama administration is going to, you know, is going to react to that pressure. I think you're right to suggest that if there were to be a war before the November election here in the United States, all bets are off in terms of a possible re-election for the Democrats. But I think the much more, you know, dangerous scenario is not really what will happen in terms of Obama's re-election, but what will happen in the Middle East and the entire world in terms of the global economic recovery, the price of oil, the spreading of conflict in the region beyond Afghanistan, beyond Syria, beyond a very unstable situation in Iraq. To add on top of all of that, you know, a war with Iran would really be a catastrophic scenario that I hope we don't have to face. But judging from the rhetoric, it seems like we're heading down that direction.
Again, I'm speaking with Nada Hashemi, who is a professor of Middle East and Islamic politics at the Joseph Corbell School of International Studies at the University of Denver, and the author of The People Reloaded, The Green Movement and the Struggle for Iran's Future. Well, let's talk about the Green Movement. I mean, it would seem to me, there's no question that this is an odious regime, and it's become clearly much more militarized since the stolen elections and the people rose up. In many ways, just like the Russian people did recently, you know, if you got a kind of fictional democracy, and even the fictional democracy becomes fraudulent, it's just too much of an insult. And it seemed in both cases, in Russia recently and in Iran a few years ago, the people just had enough. They were brutally suppressed by the religious police, this horrible religious militias, which I don't think the American people can even conceive of what it would be like, even though we have a lot of theocrats voting for Santorum in this race. The idea of theocratic police beating citizens and using razor blades and stuff like that is just so hideous. So there's no point in, we have complete agreement on how odious these people are. And we also, you know, have been told by Shirin Ebadi, the Nobel laureate, that, you know, the embers are burning beneath the ashes. Tell us whether there's any hope that the Iranian people can free themselves from this horrible regime.
Well, I think there is hope, and I think actually the Arab Spring has actually given and provided a much more suitable regional context in which an internal struggle for democracy and transition can take place. But just to go back to what we were talking about, any, I think, successful movement for democracy also requires, you know, a suitable international context, a context in which a country is on the verge of war, where both sides are ratcheting up the pressure, where there is an attempt by the regime to rally the nation around the flag, when there's a very serious concern about a possible military strike. That international context, in other words, the policies of the United States and Israel and Europe, are actually making the internal struggle for democracy much more difficult because of the possible threats of war. But I think internally within Iran, the regime is very vulnerable, and I think its biggest fear, actually, is really from its own population. And you can just see it in the policies that it's pursuing. A couple of weeks ago, the regime staged this very fraudulent parliamentary election that it claimed was free and fair. The election results that were announced were that 64% of Iranian citizens allegedly turned up at the polls, and it's interesting that that figure of 64% is almost exactly the figure that the Supreme Leader predicted would turn up at the polls 2 months ago. So internally, the regime is trying to sort of, you know, crush all internal dissent. The internal struggle for democracy right now, I think, is at a very difficult point. The Green Movement leadership is effectively under arrest. All of the intellectuals, all of the leading sort of activists have either been imprisoned, silenced, killed, or they've been forced to flee into exile. So, you know, it's a very difficult moment internally with respect to Iran, but I think one can't have a serious discussion about the internal prospects for democracy in Iran without referencing what's really much more pressing at this moment, and that's the possibility of an external military strike and what that would mean for the internal prospects for democracy, which is one reason why I'm so against U.S. policy and critical of the broad-based sanctions that we're seeing, because one of the negative consequences of the policies that the United States are pursuing is that it would effectively, if there is a military attack on Iran, set back the pro-democracy struggle by at least another generation. So I think those are my views on the internal prospects for democracy in Iran and its connection to the international context that we've been talking about.
Well, just in closing, though, Dr. Hashimi, it seems that the politics, the political spaces, have been even squeezed so far to the right. You've got basically the Supreme Leader trying to put the President Ahmadinejad out of business. Isn't that what's going on?
Yeah, correct. I mean, what you're seeing right now in Iran is basically an internal struggle between different segments, different political camps of the hard right. Hardline, right-wing spectrum of Iran's political constituency. It's basically, two groups that have no, ideological principles that are worth really talking about, but they're basically interested in, naked political power, and it's the camp of the Supreme Leader versus the camp of Ahmadinejad trying to, outdo one another, and it's pretty clear that it's the camp of the Supreme Leader that is ascendant. And now it's feeling much more confident after this fraudulent parliamentary election that they staged. So that's the internal, at least on the face, struggle. But as you mentioned before, underneath, within Iranian society, a lot of discontent, a lot of anger, a lot of sort of concern over deteriorating economic and political conditions, which I think can be used ideally to support an internal struggle for democracy. But that can only happen with a suitable international context. And unfortunately, the international context that seems to suggest that we are on the verge of war is not working in the favor of Iranian Democrats right now. It's actually strengthening the regime in many ways, which is why I think the regime is very happy in terms of talking about its nuclear program, standing tough, and engaging in that type of discourse. What the regime does not want to talk about are the dozens, hundreds of political prisoners in its jails, the fact that just recently Reporters Without Borders gave Iran the distinction of being the largest prison for journalists in the world. These are things that the regime does not want the international community to know about. And I think that's really where the conversation needs to be shifted, which is why I think if we can somehow resolve or get beyond the nuclear question, it will make it much more difficult for the regime to survive. And eventually it will succumb to the democratic aspirations of the Iranian people.
Well, I thank you so much for joining us here today, Nader Hashimi.
Happy to be with you. Thanks.
Again, I'm speaking with Nader Hashimi, who is a professor of Middle East and Islamic politics at the Joseph Corbell School of International Studies at the University of Denver. His latest book is The People Reloaded, The Green Movement and the Struggle for Iran's Future. We're going to take a brief station break and we'll be back talking about the race for what's left in terms of global resources. Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters. This is Background Briefing. And joining us now is Michael Clare, the Fife College Professor of Peace and World Security Studies and Director of the Fife College Program in Peace and World Security Studies at Hampshire College. His books include American Arms Supermarket, World Security, Challenges for a New Century, Rogue States and Nuclear Outlaws, Blood and Oil, and his latest book just out, The Race for What's Left, The Global Scramble for the World's Last Resources. Welcome to Background Briefing, Michael Clare.
I'm pleased to be back again.
And clearly, Michael, there are two things going on here. The price of gasoline, which has made the president vulnerable for re-election, arguably it's the strongest suit that the Republicans have, assuming they will eventually pick their nominee. And then you've got this speculation going on Wall Street that people I've spoken to have recently say that it basically is about a third of the cost of what we pay at the pump is due to Wall Street speculation, which is the most predatory and unproductive thing imaginable, particularly at a time when we're in an economic recovery. But then if you step back into a broader frame, what you're saying in the race for what's left, the global scramble for the world's last resources is what?
Well, what I'm saying is that we're in a new geological epoch or a new resource epoch, in the sense that all of the easy oil has now been depleted permanently. The oil that's very cheap to produce and cheap to refine and cheap to deliver, that's now gone. So all that's left on the planet is very expensive oil, tough oil to develop. And that's what we're relying on, deep offshore oil, Arctic oil, oil derived from difficult geological formations like Canadian tar sands and shale oil, and oil derived from war zones. And that jacks up the price as well. And this is a permanent factor. Doesn't matter if Wall Street gets involved or the war situation in Iran calms down. That'll bring prices down a bit. But we're increasingly relying on increasingly expensive oil to produce, and that will never change. That's irreversible.
So I hate to quote Newt Gingrich because he's so off the wall, but the other night in his speech where he lost in both Mississippi and Alabama, but nevertheless is soldiering on and clearly is helping Mitt Romney by splitting the conservative vote, he talked about how, you know, he's made this absurd claim that he could get gas down to $2 a gallon. And he went on and on about North Dakota having billions and billions of gallons of oil. What the hell's he talking about?
He's talking about the Bakken or Bakken formation in North Dakota. And he gives the impression that there's giant reservoirs of oil like there used to be in Texas, and you drill down and oil comes spurting out. And this is a complete figment of his imagination. What there is a mammoth formation of shale rock. And the only way you could get that oil out is to fracture that formation with millions and millions of gallons of chemically laced water. And you have to drill thousands, hundreds of thousands of drills down into that rock and shatter it mile after mile after mile. There's no pool of oil. There are molecules of oil embedded in hard shale rock. And yes, you could get it out, but it's going to cost a fortune. It's going to have mammoth environmental consequences. And in the end, we're never going to get as much oil out of there that he's fantasizing about.
Well, isn't that pretty much what's happening with the Canadian tar sands, that we don't factor in the enormous amount of water that's used? The water has to be heated, and these high-pressure steam hoses separate the tar from the sands. And then all of the runoff water, billions and billions of gallons, exponentially growing every day, and then all this brackish oil-laced water that's ruined, that can't be used for anything, is then stored in these vast pools. And we're going to get to a point in Canada where the value of the water may well be greater than the value of the oil.
Exactly, Ian. The cost of producing Canadian tar sands is rising steadily because the Canadians are beginning to worry about the ultimate risk to their environment, and they're demanding higher environmental standards. And this means the cost of production is rising. And so it costs now $60, $70, $80, $90 a barrel to produce that stuff at a minimum. And so there's no way that you could bring the price of gasoline down. If the price of gasoline drops, then there'll be no incentive to produce that stuff. And, of course, we're not talking about the environmental consequences. Listen, the only way to get the price of oil down today is to have peace in the Middle East, and I mean permanent peace, some kind of rapprochement with Iran. Iran gives up its nuclear weapons program. The U.S. Make some kind of permanent accord in that region, then the speculators will be out of business. But I can't imagine that happening in any immediate time frame.
Again, I'm speaking with Michael Clare, the Five College Professor of Peace and World Security Studies and Director of the Five College Program in Peace and World Security Studies at Hampshire College. His latest book just out is The Race for What's Left, The Global Scramble for the World's Last Resources. So you've got new players in the energy market, China being the biggest one, and its demand is getting close to the US's. And I just noticed that the South Sudan, where China has invested billions and billions, have just cut off the oil supply, which goes through the north of Sudan, which is broken off with this new country, South Sudan, which and the north, the leaders in the north, all of whom are indicted by the International Criminal Court, are up to their old tricks, genocide being their main foreign policy instrument, it seems, to the point now when the South Sudanese have cut off the oil supply to the Chinese. That represents apparently 6% of China's daily demand. They've also, of course, invested hugely in the infrastructure to get the oil out of Sudan. Is this an indicator that China is going to have to play a more active role in international affairs?
Well, China has already begun to play a much more aggressive role in seeking out the available supplies of petroleum, especially in Africa. Sudan is one of the places. They're also very active in Angola and Nigeria and Equatorial Guinea, and they're going to have to step up their search. They're becoming more active in the Western Hemisphere, in Venezuela and Brazil, and in Central Asia. They're very active in Kazakhstan and in Russia. So China's need for oil is becoming insatiable, and this is going to be a very dominant factor in the world's oil market. And it's the other big reason why oil prices are rising. We like to think in this country that we're the only consumers of oil. But now we're facing very stiff competition from China and India soon to come. And they're competing with us for this diminishing supply of oil. And that's why prices are rising. Nothing that we could do about that.
Well, if you look, and your book deals with the BP disaster in the Gulf, the Deepwater Horizon disaster, and it turns out, without revisiting that whole catastrophe, that BP was pushing the envelope along with Halliburton and Deepwater Horizon. But the fact is that BP has been paying off enormous debts, none of which I think are adequate, but they nevertheless are, which gives you an idea of the kind of money these oil companies have. And then when you look at what they're building up in the Arctic, these man-made islands and these unbelievably expensive platforms, what are we talking about in terms of the investments now being made to get this riskier, more difficult to get oil?
Well, indeed, Ian, as you say, this is the future of oil, these very expensive, very risky investments in the Arctic and offshore in deep waters. This summer, Shell, Royal Dutch Shell, is expected to start drilling in offshore Alaska in deeper waters, not just the man-made islands, but offshore rigs like they used in the Gulf of Mexico, now in the Beaufort Sea and the Chukchi Sea. I think this is very risky because any spill there would be far more catastrophic than in the Gulf of Mexico, which is relatively robust in its ability to overcome an oil spill. That's not true in the Arctic, where the flora and fauna are at much greater risk. And I worry, too, about offshore Brazil. This is the biggest new discovery of the 21st century, the pre-salt fields off of Rio de Janeiro. Much more complex task of getting oil out of there will require rigs far more expensive. They're talking about a expense of $250 billion, and I'm afraid you're going to have much more risky conditions there than you have in the Gulf of Mexico. They've already started having spills in offshore Brazil, and I think that's just the beginning of what we'll see.
So again, I'm speaking with Michael Clare, the Five College Professor of Peace and World Security Studies and Director of the Five College Program in Peace and World Security Studies at Hampshire College. His latest book just out is The Race for What's Left, The Global Scramble for the World's Last Resources. So I think we covered the notion that in your book you quote the CEO of Chevron, David O'Reilly, saying that one thing is clear, the era of easy oil is over. Now we're into the era of difficult oil and dangerous oil, dangerous to the environment because they're going to extremes to get it. So we can look forward to more deep water horizon disasters. I think that's a fair prediction. On the other side, demand, what is being done? Because the more I talk about this with you, the more it reminds me of the war on drugs, you know, the insanity of all those people in Mexico dying because we have such a bad habit in this country, and we also have a bad oil habit in this country. When are we going to get off this dangerous drug?
It's hard for me to say. You know, obviously, as prices rise, this is going to force more people to use public transit where that's an option, where that's even an option. It's going to force people to give up their gas guzzlers for smaller, more efficient cars, and that's a step in the right direction. But it's going to take some greater effort to see a total switch away from petroleum to other fuels. But that's essentially what it's going to take in the long run.
Well, what about the idea that so much of at least the demand due to automobiles and trucks, which is a huge part of oil demand, what about a battery? I mean, I'm astounded at what happened recently with the Chevy Volt. There were negative stories. I don't know where they came from. There's nothing wrong with that car. But General Motors is now having, they've got a surplus of them, you know? I mean, how is it possible that when you make a breakthrough and start delivering cars that don't pollute, somehow or other the public is turned off?
Well, you know, it's always true that new technology carries with it a certain amount of risk because it hasn't been perfected. That was true with the internal combustion engine in its early days. But, you know, what you have to bear in mind is that all of these technologies involve the use of resources that are scarce. The hybrid car and the all-electric cars depend on a lot of rare earths and lithium. These are also scarce resources which are disappearing and which are going to cause a lot of conflict in the future, just like oil and other sources of energy. So the solution is not to make a better car, but to think about alternative forms of transportation altogether. That's really the only long-term solution.
So you mean vast investments in public transport, which, by the way, most of the rest of the world, the Europeans and Australians and others, have much, much more developed public transportation. I guess it's the same is true in Brazil and other countries.
About producing cars that get 100 miles per gallon. The technology to do that is certainly available. If we have smaller, lighter cars, they don't have to be made out of steel. They could be made out of other products that are much lighter, so you don't need to use so much fuel. That technology is within reach. In Europe, they have vehicles that get 75 miles per gallon as a matter of course. Why we don't have that, I don't quite understand, but that's another way to go.
What explains our lack of investment in public transportation?
I think this is due to a combination of factors, the efforts of the oil and the highway construction lobbies and the automobile lobbies to promote suburban sprawl, and we've all become accustomed to that. I understand the appeal that everybody wants to have a house on an acre of land, and we've been living our life. That's been promoted as the American dream, and many people are wedded to that dream. I don't want to dismiss it. I think it's not necessarily the best thing for the American family. I think that with the long commutes that people have to live that dream, it doesn't necessarily bring families together. I think it brings them apart. I think when we find ourselves living in more tightly knit communities around public transportation, we'll discover that that's actually a better thing. But we have to re-envision the American dream in a new way that's more tightly packed around public transit. And that's really the issue. It's not just cars and transit, it's our the way we live our communities. We have to re-envision American communities in a new way.
Well, surely, though, I'm puzzled, though, why the oil company executives, we just quoted this, the CEO of Chevron, saying that the era of easy oil's over. Why are they investing so much money in lies and greenwashing? And why aren't they educating the American people about what they understand?
Look, they sell oil. That is their business. They have gas stations all over the country and refineries and pipelines. I mean, you can't blame them. That's what they do. They have a product. They want to sell it. They're the pusher man, and we're the customer, and that's the business they want to promote. And, you know, as long as we go along with that and buy their product, we're part of that process. We have to become customers for alternative products. And then their business model will collapse.
So there's no way that you could ask them to be less short-sighted and more with a longer view, that they'd like to stretch this resource out?
No, that's not what they're in business for. I mean, there are people in Silicon Valley and other parts of California and the Pacific Northwest who have a different concept of energy around renewables, wind power, solar power, alternative forms of transportation based on electricity, who are developing, you know, whole new concepts of how to deliver energy and transportation that are going to offer us new products. And when we turn en masse to those alternative products, then the oil companies will either go out of business or they'll join the stampede to the new energy products. But so long as they have customers for oil, that's all they're going to do.
Well, just in closing, Michael Clare, what do you think is... I would have thought that the Deepwater Horizon would have been a big wake-up call for the American people, as the Santa Barbara oil spill was years ago. Earth Day was created and an environmental consciousness arose out of that. I don't see much, of a reaction to what happened with the Deepwater Horizon. So does that mean something incredibly catastrophic is going to have to happen before people recognize that we can't go on pushing the envelope on this planet, searching for this increasingly scarce resource and taking greater and greater risks with our environment?
Well, Ian, I think what we're going to have is a slow emergency and big catastrophes occurring repeatedly. I mean, we have a slow emergency right now, which is high oil prices, and this will force people to alter their behavior, not because of a green consciousness or a concern over the environment or the climate or anything like that, because they can't afford to pay for it. And they're going to make decisions based out of practical need. They'll trade in their SUVs for something else. So there's a slow emergency underway. But there will be more catastrophes, environmental catastrophes ahead, and that will prompt more changes of this sort in time. There's no question about it.
Well, I thank you so much for joining us here today, Michael Clare.
It's been my pleasure, Ian, always.
Again, I've been speaking with Michael Clare, the Five College Professor of Peace and World Security Studies and Director of the Five College Program in Peace and World Security Studies at Hampshire College. His books include American Arms Supermarket, World Security, Challenges for a New Century, Rogue States and Nuclear Outlaws, Blood and Oil, and his latest, just out, The Race for What's Left, The Global Scramble for the World's Last Resources. This has been Background Briefing. I'm Ian Masters. I would like to thank producer Graham Fitzgibbon. This program is available for podcasting at ianmasters.com, where you can also contact me. And I'll be back on Sunday at 11 with another Background Briefing.
Bye for now.